Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to this episode of the New Books Network podcast. I'm thrilled here today to be discussing The Concrete Plateau, Urban Tibetans and Chinese Civilizing Machine with the author Andrew Grant, Dr. Andrew Grant. I'm a new host, and this is my first episode interviewing an author for the New Books Network. When I first saw Andrew's book come out, I immediately reached out to him for the interview, because I knew that this could be my first interview on the network. So I'm very, very excited that we could do this. And I'm also very grateful to Dr. Andrew Grant for accepting to be here. I have really enjoyed reading the book, and I'm looking forward to discussing it and learning more about your work in this conversation. To briefly introduce Professor Andrew Grant, he is a political geographer, who is at the moment a visiting scholar of international studies at Boston College. He holds a PhD in geography from UCLA. His research interests broadly concern the role of urbanization, borders, and other materials in global geopolitics, marginalized groups. Now, without further ado, let's begin. And let me ask Dr. Grant the classic New Books Network question. Could you tell us about your academic background and how did you come to work on this particular book project?
Well, first of all, thank you so much, Paul Dengel, for reaching out to me and for being able to have this conversation with you. I really appreciate the opportunity to talk about my book. I became, first interested about the city of Xining, which is the main topic of my book, when I was after I was an undergraduate, and I spent a year there teaching English at one of the colleges. And at this time, this was 2007-08, so the city was really just starting to develop. So I develop in terms of sort of the most recent efflorescence of urbanization that's gone on there. So my background before that was I had been a geography major in an undergraduate program, and I was at that time applying to graduate schools, and I initially wanted to do something with cultural geography and sacred mountains in Tibet, but instead I became interested in some of the more political aspects, so I got my PhD in political geography. So other than that, I mean, I've knowledge of China, and I've also studied Russia in the past, or my minor as an undergraduate was Russian stuff. So I guess I've always been interested in political borderlands.
Thank you for that. So this might be a little bit of a spoiler, but I first want to ask briefly, again, you can answer this briefly, what's the central argument of the book?
Yeah, thanks. The book it's a work of political geography that takes urbanization very seriously and centrally. And one of the arguments I was trying to make is that, rather than looking at, as I think is common, that urbanization within China is something that is being used in Tibetan areas to sort of fully assimilate the population, and that there is that there are no politics in that, right? So if you read, so instead of that, I'd say, yes, there is a politics to it. There is a lot of agency. And I'm coming at this because a lot of the literature on urban politics is literature that has, I guess you could say, it's like contested politics, where people are unhappy that their homes are being rebuilt, or you know, there may be protests and things like this. But right, if you go to Chinese cities, you're not too likely to see this. You can find the Nail households and other populations pushing for compensation in many places across China. But you know, I think in particular in Tibetan areas, with what in China are the government calls ethnic minorities, with indigenous groups in Western China, it's very hard for them to sort of push back against that, to assert themselves too much, because you can be accused of splitism or separatism and things like this, extremism. So this is harder to do. So I was interested to see how do Tibetans have a politics that's really a subaltern urban politics, where we can find them working to sustain, maintain, and reinvent their culture in urban areas. Mm-hmm. And I think you can find it. Yeah.
Yeah, great. So one of the kind of central frameworks, as I see it, is that which you engage in throughout the book, but particularly in the first chapter, is the idea of circular migration. And here you establish how the rural and urban divides exist only in terms of state administration and planning, but in practice, the rural places are more integrated in terms of material development and mobility of labor. And with this phenomena of circular migration, you argue how certain processes complicate the urban-rural distinction, and how this at the same time allows for the emergence of a regional modernity. So could you elaborate on how this happens, and perhaps with examples from your ethnographic work, and how, for instance, the Xining Tibetan market contributes to this process?
Yeah, sure. I'd say one of the interesting things that really comes out of this chapter is I sort of started with, you know, if you're talking about the urban, well, and the urbanization is coming to the Tibetan plateau, then what is the rural? And this resonates with all these other sorts of arguments, like core periphery, or sort of a cultural center, which has been common in sort of ethnic studies of China and that orientation. But I was also interested in this, coming at this from urban studies and development studies questions. So some of the interesting things I encountered then were these discussions of regional migration coming from studies in India, where you have people who are going to cities and often doing labor there and encountering different technologies and styles and life ways and bringing them back into rural areas. And that this wasn't necessarily a one-way process, or it wasn't just, let's take what's in the city as it's being presented and take it back with us. So the example then of Tibetans and their way of finding agency with this is many of them, people I did research with, would move between urban areas and rural areas over the course of the year, which is enabled by highways. So there was quite a bit of mobility in this. And the Tibetan market you bring up is a good example of this, because this would be an area where a lot of the people that were shopkeepers there might be staying in apartments. They weren't necessarily permanent residents of the city. They might be staying with relatives or people from their hometowns. And whether they were, you know, selling tents or hats or making posters for like vinyl printed posters for restaurants and things, you had they were really engaged in taking these technologies, newer technologies and styles, and I guess you could say adapting them for Tibetan community. And this was very important for them. They really wanted to do this. They saw this as a contribution to Tibetan culture. Meanwhile, many of their customers are also circulating. You would have, for instance, lots of the Jokpa, the pastoralist customers who would come during the winter and buying things. as well. So you had a lot of the circulation. I thought it was really interesting because the sort of vision of there being like this sort of monolithic form of urbanization that's just happening and erasing everything. Everything just becomes the rules displaced by the urban. I think in practice, if you look at it at a finer grain, you can actually see that these places are sort of collapsed into one another. Urban areas and rural areas, rural elements in the urban. Mm-hmm. And this really shapes people's desires for their families, for themselves, for their community. And it's a really interesting insight that I learned of how Tibetans are imagining their economic and social futures through this, which is why I was calling it a sort of cosmopolitan dreaming.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Yeah. This reminded me of what a conversation I had with my brother about the kind of the changing architectural landscape of Tibetan rural areas, and especially in the place where I am from, and that increasingly the new buildings are built with cement and concrete. So there is an effort among some Tibetans to keep their traditional mud houses alongside their new concrete buildings, even in the rural areas. And I thought that was a kind of interesting example of how this kind of circulation of not just people, but also materiality, right, of urban-rural kind of circulation that you were discussing.
Totally. And that's great because it really, again, that also disrupts this idea, right, that people might have that if the urban comes in, just whatever there necessarily is eliminated or there's no longer any connection to it. But you can have both of these things sort of coexisting. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Now let's move to the next chapter. And the next chapter, Remembering Xining, is a fascinating chapter. It's actually one of my favorite chapters on the Tibetan and Chinese historiography and historical discourse on the city. And it's interesting to me because here you see how Xining has become a battleground for historical memory and politics of memory. And you discuss it through the circulations of historical figures and technologies such as mythologies, memorialization practices, toponyms and names of roads, parks, etc. And here you employ the idea of chronotype as historically loaded idioms to reveal the ongoing dialogue and contestation between state narratives and Tibetan institutions. So let me ask, could you tell us how memorialization of urban landscape carried out mainly by the state and urban development programs allow and work towards the creation of a Chinese city or a Chinese Xining as a Western pacification frontier? Or in other words, in what ways do such practices contribute to the civilizing machine?
Yeah, thanks. So this brings up the topic of what a civilizing machine, which I'll revisit, but one of the, themes in contemporary China that you see, whether it's ecological civilization or the civilized city, or the Belt and Road Initiative, is this idea of the great Chinese civilization, right, which goes back 5,000 years. And is just sort of also used to kind of give this sort of depth and profundity to many of the topics in Chinese policy and discourse, because civilization, Wenming, is seen as being something very sophisticated and accomplished. So I was in this chapter, I was exploring some of the conversations that one can encounter in the memorialized landscape and also in popular books about the city of Xining, and how these relate to these different forms of civilization. So one of them was this idea that you had just mentioned, Western pacification, that Xining, like many other cities in Western China, if you go through, if you pick up the yearbook, for instance, or the annals, sort of historical annals, you can see that you know, the city is always talked about from the perspective, right, of, you could say, Meiji or Eastern China, and that the city really only shows up in that way, and it shows up as a place that's being reunified with China. And even in the landscape, when there's these memorials, there's something called the Hohong River Walk. There's a number of these sites across the city. There are lots of historical figures that are being commemorated that are not necessarily from the region. They're not indigenous to the region. They've come from Neidi, or they are groups that were, you know, cooperated and coordinated with these other governments. And in the way that they're discussed in these books and plaques and memorialized things, they're often getting skills. This is sort of like the Princess Wenchung thing you can encounter in Laos. So they're getting skills that they're being taught basically by historical Chinese empires. Or they have spent time in the Neidi, and where they have been sort of made more culturally Chinese. So there's a lot of this reminding you of the connections, or I remember one of them was even emphasizing the fact that it was, you know, tying it to the contemporary period of ethnic Ronghua, of this assimilation. So it's saying that, you know, for thousands of years, basically this process of getting good stuff and being pacified and peace having brought is happening. The other one I was interested in was one that was more about Chinese mythology, this idea of Kunlun civilization. So the Queen Mother of the West, and this isn't exclusive to the city of Xining, because local governments, municipal, county level, will try to develop tourism economies around this. But once again, even like there's these very old trees in the landscape, and you know, even these trees have been narrated as being part of either Kunlun civilization, or they were brought by, they date from the time of Princess Wenchung. So I was calling this is more of a, not so much a historical chronotope, but a chronotope of eternal connection, because these things are, owe themselves quite a bit to folklore.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. The next chapter, which is Civilized City, is where you examine how programs of civilizational development have been deployed as material and aesthetic practices, and how these programs aim at producing ideologically homogeneous and modern places through control of social behavior and urban landscape in general. And more specifically, you discuss how this civilizing machine as a biopolitical machine through population governance and management of bodily practices. And here, could you discuss how and why such measures are necessary for the realization of a civilized city? Or in other words, what does it mean to civilize a city for the Chinese state? And what are some of its presumptions about civilized city and its residents?
Yeah. So one of the term, again, civilizing machine I'm using in the book, I'm interested in ideas of assemblage of different ways that cities can be materially and discursively assembled. So, you know, this memory I just talked about, or these chronotopes, this was one way of assembling the, you could say, symbolic or cultural content of the city to make it more cinified. But there's also material elements, right? And so one of the things I'm interested then is what are the different things that are brought into the city in order to realize it as something that's sort of civilized, and part of that will be the material landscape, but also the people within it and their bodies. So how does the civilizing machine want to assemble or need to assemble certain types of bodies and places? And where does it get this from? And what does it need to remove and expel for this to happen? So if you look at the city of Xining, and you look at the way that it's being redeveloped, you'll see that there it's resembling more and more cities that would be sort of models from Neidi, from Inner China. And these areas become the places that are considered sort of standards or models of the most civilized urban districts. And this is something that comes up in conversations. You can ask people, like, you know, what are the parts that seem the most civilized? And it's, you know, which basically means that has the most civility. And one of the interesting things is it's sort of attached to an aesthetic and to an economy. So one of the newest districts in the city at the time, called New Lake District was this place that had been built from scratch. And it was like, as you know, I remember one of my participants telling me, it was like entering a new standard city when you crossed into it. It was very green, very shiny, lots of glass. It's a real break from the sort of, you know, socialist era urban landscape, or even the early 2000s landscapes that are in other parts of the city. But one of the things about that city, that part of the city, is it has big sidewalks for walking. It has better, just from the perspective of urban planning, better ways to manage population mobility for an era with more car ownership and stuff. And the houses themselves are more likely, the apartment buildings, to have things like basements where cars can park. So there's this, what happens then is that the older parts of the city, and in particular the parts of the city that have historically concentrations of Muslims, and also where, say, the colleges and government organizations, where you've had over the last couple decades more Tibetans move. This includes the Tibetan market and the rail, the bus stations and the railway station. These areas become devalued. They become seen as the places where crime is, where they're the dirtiest. And I would then, you know, talk to Tibetans who were opening businesses, and they, you know, they desired to be in sort of the newer centers. Really, lots of people did. To be in these places because they were seen as more shufu, more comfortable, better economies, more convenient. But at the same time, if you were to talk to, you know, I also talked to Muslim groups, and I talked to Han, and one of the overwhelming senses you get is that these new areas are not really places where the minoritized ethnic groups are visible. So there's a very strong normative pressure. So when I was there in 2017, they actually had this this national competition for the civilized city, which was acting on the body. So this is what I'm talking about, assembling the body, right? That there are certain ways of crossing the road, certain ways of disposing of your garbage, certain ways of speaking standard Putonghua Mandarin that are sort of more expected in these parts of the city. And I would, you know, talk to Tibetans and things that felt that, you know, like these conversations about the moving centers, about the way that the sort of civilizational conceit is being deployed, I think would kind of work into these ideas that the government was devaluing Tibetan culture or misappropriating its wealth in order to not actually help what people really needed.
Mm-hmm. That's great. Thanks. Related to that, the next chapter offers a critique of the civilizing machine by exploring how Tibetans have developed alternative views on the city and the values attached to it, right? And yes. Now, of course, part of the reason why the civilizing machine has failed is, although it got officially recognized as a civilized city in 2017, the process of transforming Xining into a civilized city, in this process, it produced uneven spaces of relative progress and development, and neighborhoods that are dominated by Muslim or Tibetans are looked upon as places or districts of crime and uncleanliness. And in this kind of peripheralization of certain communities in the city. Of course, this is not the only reason why Tibetans are critiquing urbanization and city life, but there seems to be an attitudinal sort of difference or a basis for why Tibetans have launched a kind of discourse of critique against urbanization and urban life, or against this teleological developmental logic that everyone must in the end kind of end up in city. So could you discuss this?
Yeah, sure. This is, so to go back to this idea of the civilizing machine and the city being assembled, one of my main arguments then is that to find the politics and the agency is that people who are, even if they're positioned at the periphery, and I mean this in the sense of, you know, informal economies like you find at the Tibetan market, or not being the dominant population in the city, not living necessarily in this new high standard world class urbanism that's being built, and being the new center. The people from the margin, they also can plug their projects and their cultural investments into the urban environment. So I was looking then at the ways that Tibetans critique the urban. And this can be, you know, sort of drawing from the great tradition of Tibetan Buddhist civilization, or drawing from indigenous practices and just sort of local life ways. So one of the things I talk about that you were mentioning then is this idea that Tibetans seeing, Baorong tolerance was one of the terms that was often bundled with this civilized city discourse, that people should be tolerant. And this is actually shows up in a lot of urban mottos across China, including in the motto of Xining. But the city of Xining itself could be rejected, right, as being intolerant. So I it was interesting to have people telling me sort of about the superficiality of this. So much of this, you know, whether it's the spectacle of the world-class city, or it's the sort of passive ways, the kinds of ropes and things that they're using to change people's behavior, that there's a superficiality of it to it, that the urban itself can lead to deceitful behavior. And, you know, this would come up in conversations like, there's dimensions related to these ethnic identities as well. So for instance, one pastoralist woman I met who was telling me a story about her uncle who had come to the city to go to the hospital. He brought dairy products with him and kept them in his chuba, in his coat. And the people on the bus were commenting, you know, that he was dirty and that he smelled. She thought this was, right, an example of how Xining wasn't tolerant. But even at the hospital, all the Han Chinese, the doctors could suggest was, you know, this person, that their hygiene is very bad. They need to clean, and that sort of this idea that so much of these judgments, these valuations, were just being made at sight, at basically the sensory level, which is so much about what this sort of world class urban model is, right? It is very not only in China, but when people are shopping for the nicest housing around the world, the nicest urban districts, it is very superficial. It's very materialist. So interestingly, then this critique would also go down to the level of, urban or Tibetan intellectuals have also written about this, sort of critiquing, as you were mentioning, sort of this civilization, the teleological expectation that the Chinese program, the state-led urbanization, the demands that people move to urban areas and modernize, and this is the only way forward, is itself not, it's not the only option for them or for anybody. And, you know, there's all kinds of critique. So one of the examples I bring up, there's a number of poets, maybe you can expand upon them. Bolingel, I know, you know, quite a bit about this, but I talk about a music video that which is called Zhongcheer City, and this singer Lobsang Nyima, and it is great because there's the lyrics are from Men La Jab, and there's a cinematographer who's worked with a number of other music videos. It's very much an urban product, a product of urban skill, but it's a critique of the city for things like getting people to get into fights, to drinking, but also really beautiful lyrics that hearken to, you know, Tibetan Buddhist ideas of the mind and samsara, and how the urban presents all these distractions, pushes the mind to be rushed. So these images of the city, the video opens with this great image that I wanted to be on the cover of the book, but I didn't pursue trying to find permissions for it. But I love the image, and it's a great music video. It starts the beautiful Tibetan, you know, the snowland landscape, the Tibetan plateau, white and blue and green, you're zooming over it. And then the top image is sort of the inverse, and it's like this polluted urban cityscape that's yellow and dark. And you're sort of flying between these two planes. And I thought that was a really good critique of, you know, where is the beauty, where is the aesthetic? Now, I don't mean to say that, and I think it's a really important point that I try to make in the book. Tibetans do not, or, you know, the Tibetans I talked with in many of the videos I watched and things I read, there was rarely a full rejection of the urban, but there was a desire that the urban not necessarily be, you know, marginalize them so much, and that if they, you know, if Tibetans could make the urban work for themselves and they had more input, then it wouldn't be quite as damaging economically, socially, culturally.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. It was very interesting. Again, you also discuss in this chapter about not just the kind of artistic productions like the song by Lobsang Nyima, but also literature, right? Poetry, of especially of the third generation poets, and how the city became a kind of a very important and immediate concern for them to kind of give expression to the experience of traversing the concrete, right, the city, and how this kind of came to be seen as an existential threat to the Tibetan way of life, and because this is where massive scale of assimilation happens in city, and I've always kind of found it a little ironic that that this poets and writers, intellectuals, are critiquing against the city, but most of the time they are living in the city and they're kind of writing about the rural life. And this, I found that very kind of interesting. And
yeah, it's a great topic that deserves further exploration. Absolutely. And maybe I would add here, because this brings up for me, you know, some of the ideas of what would people, or, you know, what are some of the ways then beyond these critique that Tibetans have made an effort to make the urban, or, you know, what might they want from the urban that's being this difficult to get, and how do they go about it? So one of the things was that it is not, Qinghai is not a Tibetan autonomous province, and Xining is not a Tibetan autonomous city. And there are, it's hard to get Tibetan language education. So if you're growing up in an urban area, and I would say many of the people I talked to wanted their children educated in Xining, often at Chinese language schools, so that they would have good economics, good prospects in the future. But there was this growth of supplementary education, supplementary education that would often occur during winter breaks, where there would be Tibetan classes within the city. I interviewed some of the teachers that were involved in that. There were also during the summer, the importance, the necessity of going back to villages in order to learn from elders, in order to sort of embody dispositions like how to tie a robe, how to treat teachers, all of these things were important, and people would and talk about how they wanted to sort of strategize. Maybe I'll send my child to the village for primary education and then to the city for secondary education. And also, though, this being tied up in a fear that even their villages would be urbanized and lose their Tibetan characteristics. But another one, to return to this idea of the history and the memory of the city, was that, you know, even these memorialized and the toponyms of places within the city of Xining, there were debates or histories that were being provided that maybe some of these names are, they're actually Tibetan names, or we've talked about that the Tsongkha kingdom of the 11th century was actually in Selang, which is the Tibetan word for Xining, so that this is really a fundamentally Tibetan city. And I have this that I republished in a book, a great map by Tibetan scholar and researcher Dobie Chadru. And I think it really, the level of articulation of this city, I think is very important, because then other Tibetans can learn about it, and then they don't just see the city as this, you know, the story of the Chinese pacified city, which is what you would get from typically from these sort of Sino-centric stories. And there's also stories to be told about the Muslim city, perhaps even the Mongol city. That's one of the ways that people can kind of bring this into the city, bring agency, yeah, assemble it.
Yeah, thank you. I just wanted to add that when this kind of idea of the countryside, right, as a cultural reservoir where Tibetan attitudes can be inculcated, is interesting, because you see kind of similar phenomena happening even outside Tibet in cities like New York City. Tibetans send their kids to go and study Tibetan culture and language in Dharamsala or South India over the summer, or even for sometimes like year. So we are coming towards the end, as for the last chapter, we have, which is building a Tibetan city, and this is where you kind of touched a bit on how Tibetans remember the city and Tibetans involved in building a Tibetan city, right? And here you argue how Tibetans living in the city imagine the city as both a place of cultural destruction and also a place of cultural and political possibility. So in what ways do Tibetans actively kind of assert their presence and create and contribute towards making Xining a Tibetan city?
So in this chapter, I'm really interested in placemaking and how Tibetans were making places, whether it was their urban home, a business, restaurants, or their xiaochu, or Rakor, which was the name for the housing community, which mm-hmm. Chinese cities are divided into, what they did in order to really make themselves at home, essentially, but also be able to meet and network with other Tibetans. And I found that this occurred across the city, but that it wasn't very easy. And this really comes back to the conversation about that we began with about contested politics, right? That you can't say in New York, if you want a road commemorated or if you want a community center built, you can apply to have this done. There's just democratic avenues through which you can pursue these things. Not always the case in China, where there's a lot more petitioning that needs to go on, or just trying to sort of stay under the radar. So I'll talk about this in terms of restaurants that are often sort of, you have to learn about through word of mouth, that are in high rises. I've talked to some of the restaurant owners that will talk about sort of not wanting too many Chinese to learn about the restaurant, because then it would sort of ruin the atmosphere. But then also decorating often these restaurants so that they looked so they sort of brought a grassland element, including the cuisine, of course, but having things like the black tent, pieces of the black tent, or the urcha, which is the herding tool, and having these sorts of elements around, right? So that was an important way that Tibetans could meet and sort of have these places that they could go to that had reputations they could talk about. But there are often also difficulties. So for instance, you had some retirement communities in the city where people had been able to construct prayer wheels so that older members of the community could turn the prayer wheels. But if you did not happen to be in a housing community that was set up to permit that. And in one case, I met people who they struggled with it. It had been bulldozed the first time they tried to build it. They had to petition. It was very tense and impassioned, and they eventually were able to sort of get a compromise and build something smaller. But, you know, I think today, if we think about it, I did this research. The majority of it was between 2013 and 2017. And as we all know, in the last couple of years, in particular, you know, Islamic structures, such as those in the city that I was studying, mosques have had the domes removed, right? So this isn't just, this stuff really matters. And the way it's negotiated, there's always a risk that you could go into dangerous territory and just, you know, end up having something bulldozed, something shut down, being detained. There's always a risk of this. So this placemaking is really important, and it's a form of politics that it sort of goes on in authoritarian environments under the radar, which is one of my arguments. I'd say, and maybe just to sort of end with it, one of the most interesting things that I really enjoyed that was a real sort of place event in the city of Xining was the Tibetan gathering that happens in the summer on a park overlooking the city. And this is where people set up tents, they have competitions for clothing, for song. There's just cultural events and things like this. But this in order to do this, this is something that needs to be negotiated with municipal government. And, you know, if there is an event, I mean, if there's a problem that occurs, and much of this research I did was occurred after the stabbings that had occurred in Kunming in 2014, which had led to an increased security environment across the city. You know, there's just a risk that, especially if you have a lot of people together, that or, you know, something that's too big, too much expression, putting your head up too high, that things could, you'd cross this threshold. And that was always overhanging the community.
So. Yeah, I found the expression you use very interesting, the rhizomatic structure, right? Or rhizomatic resistance. And that is that it's kind of dispersed and there's no like single area or a single site that's very too prominent for the stage to be crushed, but different areas, they've been kind of dispersed, diffused across the city, like the Gora place or squares where Tibetans gather and dance, right? It's another kind of practice of placemaking. Yeah, we've come to the end. And before we end, is there anything you want to add?
Well, I'd say, you know, one of the things I was really interested in with this is there's all these discussions of China model, and I think it's post-pandemic hit perhaps a bit of a road bump, I'm not sure, but having these urban exports of, people have written about like Johor Forest City in Malaysia, or, you know, so these are examples of China exporting these sort of world-class urban environments that I argue, you know, would carry with them. They assemble a certain material and can be invested with a certain sort of symbolic or discursive content. What might that look like in other places around the world? Would the experiences of the sort of marginalized or minoritized communities be similar? And I think this is something you could also ask for other state-led urban projects, right? Like, which we could find in other countries around the world, like in India.
All right, I believe with this we have come to the end of our conversation. But before we conclude, I want to thank you and congratulate Dr. Grant for the publication of his first book from Cornell University Press, and for coming on the New Books Network to discuss the book with me. Thank you very much, and have a lovely day.